Welcome to all of you to our Global Space Forum. Today we are very lucky to have Gérard Brachet as our host. And as you know, we started this activity, this Global Forum, Space Forum, about six months ago, and we are trying to have a different speaker every month. We had the Administrator Griffin, we had the Vice Administrator of the Chinese Space Agency, we had some congressmen, and today, for the first time, we have someone who is representing a multilateral organization involved in space, which is the UN COPIUS. So Gérard Brachet is, unlike his predecessor, very, very knowledgeable about space, where he spent most of his career. Actually, he started as a young engineer at the University of Washington State, where he got a master's degree. Then he moved into CNES, and there he had many different roles, and he was involved in all the topics of space, launchers of observation, exploration, human space flight. What's very important is as he says himself, he's a father of the Charter for Natural Disaster, which he promoted with ESA some 10 years ago now, 99. From this idea and this discussion with ESA, at the time led by Dr. Rodota, this charter grew to a multilateral, not organization, but system, with most of the space-faring nations involved and others as well. So that has been a tremendous success, and it has demonstrated some significant added value during the recent natural crisis, including the tsunami and Katrina, of course. So Gérard is now... First, I would like to stress as well that Gérard is very, very knowledgeable on the bilateral France-US cooperation in space as well. When he was general director of CNES, he pushed for the follow-on to the Topex Poseidon satellite, which is another satellite which is very famous in our world because it is said to be the satellite that discovered El Niño, and it's an example of the benefit of international cooperation. This cooperation was very painful to start, but it was not painful to keep alive, and Jason actually was a CNES NASA satellite, which was a follow-on for Topex Poseidon, and you need to know that there is beyond Jason, there is a Jason 2, which is even broader because it involves not only NASA and CNES, but as well NOAA and EUMETSAT in Europe, so it's extending and in relationship with the multilateral approach, it's an interesting process. How to start with two countries and grow it into something more international. So since June 2004, Gérard was selected to become the chairman of the United Nations Committee for Peaceful Use of Outer Space, the UN COPIUS, and he is now officially the chairman of this committee, and this is till June 2008. So I would like to welcome Gérard. He's going to give us his vision on the evolution of the space activity in the world, and he's going to address his views on how the UN COPIUS could help in this transformation currently going on in space activity. And finally, he will provide his conclusions and recommendations. So please help me to welcome Gérard. Thank you.
Thank you, Vincent, for your introduction. Maybe one thing that you didn't mention, and which in my view is the most important part of my life, is that I founded the Spot Image company in 1982. And the first decision I took was to establish a subsidiary here in Washington. And I was the chairman of the board of this Spot Image Corporation company up until I left Spot Image in 94. And during these about 10 years, I was in Washington about once every 2 months, at one time every month, in fact. And the experience of running a company here in the U.S. In a new field of application and finding that the best customer, in fact, the best customer ever in the history of the company was the U.S. Department of Defense. That was an interesting experience. So good morning to all of you, and thank you for coming here to hear what I have to say. I would like to I would like to start by saying that even though I am chairing the UN Committee for the Peaceful Use of Outer Space, I would like to stress that what I'm going to say today, to tell you, does not reflect the views of the COPIOS. I have not even checked that the members of COPIOS would agree with what I'm going to say. So everything I'm saying is in a personal capacity. And but I will, as I will show you, some of the ideas that I will be presenting this morning, I intend to present them to the COPIOS June 2007 session. I'd like to start with a brief review of the situation of space activities in the world as I see them today. And as you will see, I'm trying to do that from a global point of view without focusing on this or that particular country. I will start with something that you all know very well, and that is that the United States, with its new space exploration vision, has turned away from the Space Shuttle International Space Station strategy, which was the main line of its of its policy in the late 80s and in the 90s. Russia, who used to be one of the big actors in space, is trying very hard to find ways to become a big player again, building, of course, on its very long and vast experience and its strong industrial base. Their situation is improving, as you know, because the economy is getting better, thanks to oil and gas prices. And I would not be surprised to see them becoming more active and more proactive, I would say, on the international scene than they have been in the last 10 years, where mostly their main priority was to survive. And they did survive pretty well, in fact. China is a new player. It has become a very significant player, and it's no longer hiding its ambitions. I'd like to stress the new Chinese space policy, which came out last week. And those of you who don't know about this formal announcement of Chinese space policy, I would advise you to go to the website, which is shown here. In fact, it came out last Thursday, so some of you may not be aware of this announcement of a Chinese space policy. So I leave you time to write down the website address if you want to. It's a 6-page or maybe 8 pages declaration which reviews what their achievement in 2006 and their plans for the future. So it's very interesting, and it is not so common to see China coming up with a statement of policy, so it is an important item, I think. Okay, so let's move maybe to the next. Maybe I'm hiding the numbers. No. Okay. What about Europe? Well, as a European, I'm not extremely enthusiastic with the situation. I would describe it as saying that Europe has some difficulty defining a common space policy, and that is particularly true in the field of its future vision, what it wants to do. It's very difficult. The European Union is trying to be the defining area where policy in space can be established and can be approved. But beyond a statement of intent, that has not translated so far in a really very visible action, so much so that the European Space Agency, which, as most of you know, is an independent body from the European Union, the European Space Agency continues to be, and I guess will continue to be, the prime organization for implementation of non-military space programs in Europe. India has developed, as you know, a very successful applications-oriented space program, and now displays new ambitions in space science and exploration. So this is also, I would say, an evolution which is notable. India, so far, had been concentrating very much on the application side of their program, very successfully, I must say. But now it is clear that they want to go beyond that. And their credibility from a technical point of view, from a programmatic point of view, is well established now. So this is very, very true. Now, some developing countries also are becoming more active participants. You see countries like Nigeria, Algeria, Malaysia, Thailand, and many others, South Africa, of course, Brazil and Argentina. These are at various levels of development. Brazil is maybe the most advanced of all of them. They are becoming actors, and they are becoming actors mostly via the access to microsatellite-based satellite system, which has one advantage. First of all, it's not very costly, but also it gives them access to the notion of what is a space system. So I would say that it is a very good and very efficient introduction to space system and space technology at a limited level of investment. And that explains to a large extent why so many of the developing countries are joining the space club. Now let's reflect a little bit on the prime motivation for governments to invest in space activities. I'm talking about government investment. I'm not talking about private investment here. Government investment usually in this area is based on the purpose of achieving scientific research, exploration, discovery objectives. It's a bit like building a large observatory. Space, after all, is a very useful observatory base. But of course, many countries involved in space technology and space activities are motivated also by the need to put space at the service of society. So applications to satisfy society's needs is also a prime motivation. And then, of course, security and defense. Security and defense is very often the prime motivation, although it is not always stated as so. But let's be clear about that. I would say 80% of decision to go to space in various countries is based on long-term security and defense logics. Let's say a few words about each of them. First of all, scientific research and exploration, which are prime drivers for space activities. Well, I would say that there is exploration side of it, which so far has been primarily robotic, the exception being, of course, the Apollo mission to the moon. And that includes, of course, the bodies of the solar system, but it also includes the universe beyond the solar system, our galaxy, and beyond our galaxy. But also includes something which is very important, and that is research done to improve our understanding of our own planet. Global change, climate mechanisms, atmospheric processes, oceans, land masses, internal Earth physics, which lead to earthquakes and other problems of that type. And this is important to remember that when we talk about scientific research and exploration, we should not forget our own planet, because after all, we live on it. A few illustrations. At the end of next month, unless the launch has been delayed, there is a spacecraft called Koro, which is the first exoplanet discoverer in space, which will be launched on a Soyuz launcher. And this is a joint venture between CNES in France and the European Space Agency. ESA has the Aurora program, which is aimed at exploration, mostly in a robotic with a robotic approach. And this is illustrated with this rover in the surface of Mars. But of course, there are much more ambitious missions being planned, one of them in a conjunction between ESA and NASA, such as the long base interferometry in the solar system, LISA, which, by the way, calls upon very advanced technology, so much so that probably a precursor mission will have to be organized to demonstrate the technology for this very, very long base interferometry in space. But as I said, our own planet is a very interesting one because there are many phenomena that we don't understand very well. Vincent earlier mentioned TOPEX Poseidon and the follow-on mission JASON. This is a result of processing altimetric data from JASON 1 and ANVISAT. ANVISAT is an ESA satellite which is on a sun synchronous orbit, while TOPEX Poseidon and JASON are on a more inclined orbit at about 56 degrees. This allows the deriving of such maps, which is what is called a map of the topography of the ocean. In other words, it describes the very, very slight undulation of the ocean, which are linked to transport current processes. And this is a view of the ocean that is provided every 10 days. So we can see the dynamics of the ocean. We have a global view of the dynamics of the ocean that we never had before. We have another example here over the Mediterranean Sea, but this example here shows how from a description of the status of the ocean, then a forecast of the, in this case, Mediterranean Sea, but it can be done in other ocean areas, forecast can be derived describing the state of the ocean 10 days from now or 15 days from now in the same way that weather forecast is done. And this is a very significant progress made in the last 20 years in ocean science. And as you know, this is very important because ocean is a reservoir of heat and had a very, very strong impact on our climate. So this kind of data is used today by weather organizations such as NOAA here in the U.S. in producing what is called medium-term climate prediction, that is, what kind of climate are we going to have next summer or the winter after next summer. It's not a weather forecast. It's a climate forecast. Is it going to be a very hot summer or a cool summer, or that kind of thing? This is a new development which is very much linked to the our better understanding of transport of heat through the ocean circulation. Let's turn to the applications of space system to satisfy society's needs. Of course, that includes two categories of application, what I call the public good applications, and I just mentioned one, meteorology, environment monitoring, civil protection, search and rescue. These are not really market-driven applications. These are typically in the class of the public good application funded by governments, or at least to a large extent funded by governments. And then you have the commercial, the market-driven application, such as telecommunication, broadcasting, navigation services. And of course, you will be surprised that I have put navigation services in this category. And that is simply because in Europe, we consider that the navigation services should be paid by the user instead of being paid by a taxpayer. Here in the U.S., it's different because the GPS is funded by the Department of Defense, and the civilian application is a spin-off, in fact, of the GPS. Those applications require a close connection with scientific research in the first instance, and also with technology research, technology development, which is taking place very often in the area of scientific and discovery missions. As I said, the European Galileo satellite navigation constellation is supposed, in the end, to be supported by its user base. It's a bit early to say whether that is going to happen really or not. Right now, as you know, the development phase is entirely funded by the government. In fact, 50% via the European Union and 50% via ESA. But the deployment of the constellation and its operation and maintenance is supposed, in the end, to be purely a private sector operation. Knowing a little bit about this, I can tell you this is very ambitious. One interesting factor which we'd like to point to at this point is that applications, for example, in the field of navigation, the commercial application very, very often, if not always, combine navigation capability provided by the navigation system and communication capability, which may be provided by a cellular network or may be provided also by maritime type of communication or mobile communication by satellite. But the combination of this is very powerful, and that is what is creating value on the market. Vincent earlier mentioned the charter, Space and Major Disasters, which I had the honor to introduce in the Unispace 3 conference in 1999 in Vienna, together with Antonio Rodota. Today we have 20 agencies who have signed on the charter. For the U.S., NOAA is a lead agency. And the charter has developed very, very well over the last few years. And in fact, we just went through a new step last week, as in the UN General Assembly, I presented a resolution on a new program which would increase the reach of the charter within the United Nations. And this resolution was approved by the by at least the working group that I was chairing last week, and it should be approved by the fourth committee of the General Assembly probably on Thursday. And so this is really additional development based on the charter approach. The image, of course, you will have recognized is New Orleans, taken by Spot 5 on September 2 last year. Another program which I always quote, and Dick Barnes somewhere will be happy that I do, is COSPA-SARSAT. COSPA-SARSAT is a program for search and rescue that was initiated in the late 70s, first as a cooperation between U.S., Canada, and France, that is the SARSAT side of it, and COSPA is the Russian side of it, which at the time, of course, was the Soviet Union. We signed an agreement in what was called Leningrad at the time, in 1979, and we developed a system combining search and rescue detector, processor, receiver on board the NOAA spacecraft on the western side and a similar type of system on the Russian side. And of course, because of restriction on transfer of technology, there was no common parts at all. between the two systems. So the challenge was to define the interoperability specification sufficiently well that both systems could become interoperable and compatible without sharing any of the technology. That was an interesting exercise. But we did it. The first system was set up in 82, the first beginning was set up in 82, and the system has been in operation since 1982. It's so successful that the decision was taken to continue the system on Galileo, and I understand that in the U.S. side, similar decision will be forthcoming to carry this kind of transponder on GPS. More than 17,000 lives have been saved since the system started operation, and this is illustrated by a rescue operation at sea following a Costa-Pasta distress alarm relayed by the system. Needless to say, I was personally involved in the beginning of this venture. Security and defense was the prime motivation for the U.S. and for the USSR during the Cold War. Today, it is still a major element of national space policy in many countries, including mine. Indeed, space technology, as we all know, is very close to aerospace and missile technologies. But beyond that, the demonstration of an ability to master space system is a very good indicator of the military and defense capability of a given state. And of course, the China investment in this area, in my view, is primarily dictated by the need to make this demonstration. It's a political as well as a strategic objective. Launcher technology are very similar to long-range missile technology. Here we have taking off of an Ariane 5. By the way, there was a launch last Friday, which was successful with DirecTV and Optus D1, if I'm not mistaken. The two solid rocket boosters on Ariane 5 use a lot of the technology which was developed originally in France for the nuclear missile defense. But Vincent knows more than I about all this. Reconnaissance military satellites use basically the same technologies as civilian Earth observation satellites, and I am illustrating this with drawing of the Helios 2 reconnaissance spacecraft operated by the French Ministry of Defense. The platform for the spacecraft is the same as the platform for our civilian Spot 5 satellite, although the part of the payload, of course, is different because Helios 2 has payload characteristics which, as you know, are classified. But basically, we are speaking of the same technology. Typical reconnaissance satellite image. Of course, this is not a Helios 2 image because I would not be allowed to show you. In fact, this is a Spot 5 image, but this is a kind of image that our friends from the reconnaissance intelligence community are using every day. Let's say a few words now about manned space activities, because after all, I have not mentioned them so far. And you will find out easily why. Manned space activities were driven by strategic consideration during the last 40 years. It was really because of the political demonstration of technical capabilities, as was a fact with Apollo or China more recently. So the driving factor was not the usefulness of flying crew in space. The driving factor was a demonstration of capability. Today, my conviction is that the new emphasis on manned space exploration in the U.S. is driven by the need to reaffirm leadership on a long-term basis. And the urge to go beyond the horizon and to explore the solar system with manned mission is purely a selling point, how to sell it to the taxpayer, to the political decision makers. But the main driver is to achieve and to affirm leadership in the same way it was done at the time of the Apollo picture. And this is not a criticism. It is a fact. You may disagree with my analysis. I accept that, but this is what I feel about it. But let's be honest. After almost 50 years of space activities, manned space missions have not been able to demonstrate their cost effectiveness in any of the three areas of space application discussed above, that is space science, space application, and military application of space. This is, in fact, well recognized by most actors. Therefore, we have a question. My own belief is that manned space mission will find a new purpose within an ambitious space exploration program, even though I just said it's no use. Well, in fact, it will take place. And it is simply because humans want to participate in situ to exploration ventures. So this has nothing to do with the usefulness. It has to do with the perception by each individual that an exploration venture is not complete until one has gone there and come back, if possible, to report about it. And this is a lesson from history. Look at the competition to discover the polar regions. It is history of man. Scott and Amundsen on the South Pole. The competition to climb the highest mountains in the late 40s and early 50s. The competition even to dive to the bottom of the oceans with a manned capsule. And of course, more recently, the race to the moon. All this confirm that exploration is not considered complete as long as humans have not gone there and come back to report. And that is exactly why manned mission in exploration will take place. And again, I'm conveying personal view, personal opinion on that. So let's forget about justifications such as, you know, nuts and bolts type of thing. I believe that the new U.S. space exploration strategy introduced by President George Bush in January 2004 is indeed giving NASA a new sense of purpose, a new mission. Of course, from an international point of view, we have the question, will the international partners of NASA want to join? Well, I would say probably yes, if the conditions are acceptable, if they find a way to be involved without being in a situation of too high dependency. It's a bit, in my view, it's a bit early to give a final answer to this question. I would say that many of them are interested to participate, but the recent history of the International Space Station make it difficult to achieve any kind of agreement until Japan sees its own Japan exploration module on board and attached to the ISS, and until Europe sees its Columbus module in orbit and attached to the ISS. When this has happened and we have a stable kind of ISS situation, then the field is open, I think, for negotiating a participation in space exploration. So let's turn now to the question of the role of the UN COPIOS in this context. One has to recall that the UN Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, which, as you know, is a committee of the General Assembly, that is, it reports to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly approves or disapproves what the committee is coming up with. The main output achieved by the COPIOS has been the establishment of the legal framework for space activities at the international level. And that was done mostly in the late 60s and in the 70s. Additional work took place later in the 80s and early 90s, I will cover briefly. But the other side of the activity of UN COPIOS, which is much less visible from Washington or from Paris or from Berlin, is the work they do with developing countries, encouraging developing countries to access to space application and space activities. So there is a strong educational activity, which of course concerns mostly the developing countries. Copios played a very fundamental role in the early days because it developed the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which has been ratified by almost 90 countries, which is a basis for all of our activities, and all space actors have ratified this treaty. Beyond the Outer Space Treaty, four other international conventions have been developed. Three of them are widely ratified, and let me show you. They are the Agreement on the Rescue of Astronauts, which was signed and ratified in 1968, so 1 year after the Treaty of Outer Space. These are the Convention on International Liability for Damage Caused by Space Object in 1972, the Convention on Registration of Objects Launched into Outer Space. Those three have been ratified by most space actors. The last one, which is the Agreement Governing the Activities of Space on the Moon and Other Celestial Bodies, 1979, has been ratified only by 12 countries, none of them major space actors. So the so-called Moon Treaty is in a kind of a limbo. Legally speaking, it is in force, but in practice, it is mostly ignored by the major space actors, which, of course, open the question, what do we do with it? And I'll come back to that. But beyond those international treaties and conventions, COPIOS has also developed a number of principles which are texts, which are then submitted and adopted by the General Assembly. And, of course, the strength of these texts is much higher when the adoption takes place with unanimous consent. These are the Declaration of Legal Principles governing the activities of states in the exploration and use of outer space in 1962, which was really the first text before even the Treaty of Outer Space. Principles governing the use by states of artificial or satellite for international direct television broadcasting in 1982. Principles relating to remote sensing of the Earth from outer space in 1986. And principles relevant to the use of nuclear power sources in outer space in 1992. Personally, I know very well the principles related to remote sensing because I was involved in the drafting of the text and in the negotiation of the text in the legal subcommittee and in the COPIOS. It is the only text at the international level which applies to remote sensing. It is, in my view, vague enough to satisfy anybody. But you know what is the best, the virtue of this text? And you have to know the history of COPIOS to know what's behind it. The virtue of this text is that it killed another text, which was a text proposed by the so-called Group of 77, and which had one of its principles was the prior consent of states to gather images of their territory. If the text of the Group of 77 had been approved, that would have killed the remote sensing activities. So I remember very well in the 83-84 time frame, as we in France were preparing for the Spot satellite, we took the initiative to draft a new text, which would be a counter-proposal. We talked to our colleagues in the U.S. and in other countries, and then we sold, quote-unquote, sold the text to the Austrian delegation, and it became the Austrian text. And it went through the process of discussion into the legal subcommittee and the full committee, and it was approved as a UN General Assembly resolution in December 1986. And we are very happy to have this text today. So it's an interesting history, and that's where you want us to be careful as to what is developing over there. Now we are preparing a new one, which will probably come out next year. COPIOS will submit to the UN General Assembly a new resolution on space debris mitigation, which is largely, if not entirely, based on the guidelines developed by the Interagency Space Debris Committee, in which, as you know, the U.S. is taking a very, very strong and very active role via NASA and other participants. Thus, we have a situation where an interagency set of technical recommendations will acquire, via this resolution, the political status of a text adopted at state level. So my hope is that I will be able to present to the UN General Assembly in October next year, just a year from now, a resolution which is already more or less drafted, which in the meantime will have been approved by the COPIOS plenary in June. Why is it important? It's important because the space debris situation is very, very worrying. Today we have 620 operational satellites. We have in orbit 9,000 identified objects larger than 10 centimeters, of which 40% are satellites no longer in operation and spent rocket upper stages. 54% are fragments and other objects. 300,000 objects are catalogued between 1 and 10 centimeters, and it is estimated that object below 1 centimeter may be more than several millions. All these travel at the rate of 8 kilometers per second or 7 kilometers per second, or in the geo orbit, of course, about 3 kilometers per second. So we have a problem. We have a problem if we don't do something about it. I would say that the threat represented by growing population of space debris is significant for government, but also for private sector space assets. And it does raise another question, and that is, since outer space is a common domain, what is called in the Treaty of Outer Space, the province of all mankind, this domain cannot be subject to national appropriation, Article 2 of the Treaty of Outer Space. We therefore need to find a way to collectively agree on a set of rules to avoid space and beyond space, celestial bodies themselves, gradually becoming a dangerous place to operate in or even becoming a junkyard. The future of space activities requires that adequate safeguard and procedures be agreed, and they have to be agreed on a collective basis. And it is my belief that the good work done on the space debris mitigation guideline gives us maybe a way to go about this. I think COPIOS needs to go further beyond the space debris mitigation guideline and needs to address the issue of developing rules of the road for space operation. In fact, we are not starting from scratch. The International Academy of Astronautics has published in 2006 an interesting study report on the concept of space traffic management. In fact, I have a copy with me here. This is how it looks, but you can access to it on the web of the IAEA very easily. But it came out this year, so it's interesting to know that there is such a work already. But beyond the work done by this IAEA study, there is also the concerns expressed by satellite operators, Intelsat and Inmarsat, for example, who are talking now about the need for rules of the road to prevent collisions in the geo orbit, because they have to move their spacecraft from one location to another, and there are many spacecraft in certain locations, and that is a concern for them too. And today there is a de facto consultation taking place between the satellite operator, but there is no rule, nowhere, and probably something needs to be done. There is also a possibility of using this approach, rules of the road approach, to establish a link with the PAROS discussion at the conference on disarmament. The PAROS means the prevention of arms races of outer space. Of course, COPIOS is not involved at all in any way in the discussion on the prevention of weapons development in outer space, because we are not supposed to talk about that. It's not part of our mandate. On the other hand, I found that there is very little communication taking place between the people who sit in the conference on disarmament and discuss the matter of potential deployment of space weapons in space and those who sit in Vienna in the COPIOS. And I believe that if we were to start discussing some kind of rules of the road approach, maybe it would be good to establish some kind of a link, communication link, with the CD PAROS agenda item. It's just an idea. I believe that the UN COPIOS could play a significant role in developing such rules of the road, provided, however, and this I would say is a big if, provided that it addresses them from a technical angle. I was struck in the space debris discussion that we have been successful because we started from a technical angle, from a very strong technical basis, not from a political one. I'm pretty sure that if we had started from a political slash legal approach, we would never have achieved anything. And my suggestion here is that if we talk about rules of the road, we should not start from a political viewpoint, we should start from a technical viewpoint. That is the safety of space assets and space operation. And I intend to propose this topic as a new item to be addressed by COPIOS in the years to come. Hopefully, member delegation will take a positive view on this proposal, but of course, maybe we'll know more about that after the June meeting in Vienna. But of course, there are many other issues that COPIOS should address in the future, and I'd like to just go through a list of issues that I think COPIOS should address. First, one of them is environment protection on the surface of the Moon and other planets, possibly even introducing the concept of common heritage sites to be protected, starting with the Apollo landing sites, for example. This is an interesting idea. The IAEA is starting a study in this subject. And this is something which is, maybe we should look at it from a long-term point of view. There is no need to really find some UN text today, but maybe if you look at it from a 30 years point of view, maybe we'll be happy to have agreed to a text within the next 5 or 6 years on this subject. We also need to develop an appropriate legal regime for resource extraction on the Moon and other celestial bodies, and I believe that there is probably some interesting lessons to be taken from the application and the experience gained with the law of the sea. I believe the UN COPIOS should play an active role in facilitating international cooperation in new space ventures, and in particular in space exploration. In particular, I have one idea which I would like to push, and that is how to find a mechanism to engage the younger generation from the developing countries into space exploration. Some kind of mechanism which would not require huge funding, but which would engage them on the intellectual standpoint. And it would be very important, I believe, to find a way to get them in rather than leave them out. This is something which I will propose too. I think we also need to examine the legal implication of space tourism and develop appropriate recommendations. I know here in the US you are very advanced in this area because you have already set up the mechanism to facilitate the development of space tourism ventures, to license the operator of space tourism. That is not the case in most other countries in the world. And, of course, we will have a situation where the launch will take off from one country, the landing may take place in another country, the flights may overfly other third countries in the meantime, and there are liability questions. I'm pretty sure the insurance companies would like to have a clear situation from the point of view of their commitment, financial commitment. So some work needs to be done, starting, of course, with the what is already implied by the international treaties, but going beyond that, because space tourism is a commercial activity, which, of course, was not considered at the time where those conventions were drafted. We can even think of a discussion taking place on a decision-making mechanism for protection against near-Earth objects. There are a lot of people who say that we need to establish, to develop a collective policy-making mechanism in case one day we find that we need to try to deflect a near-Earth object coming towards us. There are some suggestions to that effect, and we will have one agenda item on this subject in our meeting in next June. Conclusion. My first conclusion, of course, is a very optimistic one. Civil space activities in the 21st century will be driven by two distinct lines of development. Participate in space exploration efforts, either in cooperation with the US or possibly in competition with them, but with a strong, strong discovery component. And again, I'm taking discovery as a whole, that is both robotic mission and man-made mission. I'm not making a separation between the two. And of course, many countries will continue to concentrate on space applications of direct use to society. And I'd like to direct you, for those of you who are interested, there is an ongoing activity at OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which has published two reports already. The last is called Tackling Society's Challenge, 2005. And now they're establishing a forum on space application, which is of quite a good level. And those of you who are interested are invited to hook on to the OECD site to know more about it. But the conclusion, too, is a little less optimistic because we have to be realistic. Continued space activities, in my view, will require a better discipline on the part of all actors. And, of course, that includes both the civil and the military actors, to preserve space as a space environment. The future security of space assets and space operation requires a concerted effort by all parties. And I believe that the UN COPIOS has a role to play. In the 21st century, outer space will continue to be an exciting story because of its very unique mixture of strategic considerations, technological challenges, scientific discoveries, and, of course, contribution to daily application. UN COPIOS should be able to continue contributing to this exciting story as it has done in the early years. And that is the conclusion, and I would like to thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Gérard, for this presentation. Many of us, I'm sure, have discovered a lot of what's going on in the UN, COPIOS. We have some time to take some questions, so who wants to shoot first?
Okay. Yes.
Dick Beneke with the Aerospace Corporation. First, I appreciate your discussion of the remote sensing and the process that went through there. Yeah. As you probably recall, I guess the previous one on direct broadcast satellites, the G77, did put through a set of principles that the United States and most of Europe voted against. And obviously, it turned out that the United States and Europe were the ones that actually set the rules for direct broadcast by getting up into outer space. Looking at what you're doing on Rules of the Road, how do you avoid a similar...
Well, first of all, I think the on Rules of the Road and possible so long road, I think we have to have a discussion between the main space actors before we put that on the table. It's a bit like what we did in the 80s with the remote sensing principle. There's no use putting something on the table if one of the major actors doesn't agree. So we have first to go through the exercise of checking if there can be an agreement on this kind of approach, within including the U.S., of course, and other major space actors, and then put something on the table, and then sell it, and again, quote-unquote, sell it to the rest of the members who are maybe less advanced in their own thinking on these matters. The number of actors who have, of course, capability to play a strong role in the discussing association is much larger than it was in the early 80s. Take the case of Brazil. Brazil is becoming a space actor. You cannot leave them out of the loop during the first stage. In the 80s, we did not ask Brazil their opinion about the remote sensing principles. So we have a different situation, so it's probably a little more difficult. I think we have to find a way to take a very pragmatic approach, but again, very much based on from the technical side. I don't believe any progress on Rules of the Road can be made from a political standpoint, because immediately we will be have the situation that they have in the CD, and that is one country says, I'm not interested, full stop. So let's look at it. Let's look at it even maybe from the point of view of the commercial operators who say we need the Rules of the Road. And if the Rules of the Road are not agreed to in the UN context, that doesn't matter. We will find a way to agree on Rules of the Road within the operators, and that's it. Well, why not? It's a possibility, but at least the attempt to look for a possible agreement in UN copios should be made. And coming back to your the first part of your comment on the direct broadcast, this comparison between the resolution on direct broadcast satellite and the remote sensing principle is very interesting, because it demonstrates once more that a resolution which has received the unanimous consent of the GA has a political weight which other resolutions do not have. So it is politically speaking, it is a major difference. I'm sure there are other questions. Well, that's a tough one. Well, let's put it that way. At this time, I don't have a good answer to your question. I realize, of course, it is a major question. That is, how do you enforce the treaty? I don't have an answer in my pocket right to come up with. Good. It's a good topic for the Space Policy Institute to look at. So I'll be watching the work done by the Space Policy Institute. Okay? Other question?
Hanina Levine, World Security Institute. To follow up on that question, aside from sovereignty claims, you suggested that for resource extraction, a good model might be the law of the sea type of system. The problem with the law of the sea is that if you look at what's happened in the sea, it's basically allowed resources to be extracted to the point of extinction, and it has not been successful at protecting fisheries and other resources in international waters. Could it be that maybe a better system needs to develop to be developed than that model?
Well, when I said lessons from the law of the sea should be taken, it doesn't mean that the law of the sea is successful. The law of the sea has limitation, as you just pointed out, at least in terms of fishing resources. So that is one of the lessons that we have to draw. In other words, we have to find a better way. For example, a licensing type of system might be the way. But I'll be a bit careful because I'm not a lawyer myself. And so I don't want to go into the discussion on the law of the sea or other legal arrangement because I will be drowned under your criticism immediately. Yes?
Hi, I'm Herb Backner with the Federal Aviation Administration. Your program seems to be one that promotes, encourages, facilitates countries and space much more so than I've seen in Copious in the past. Is that going to be part of your administration?
Well, first of all, I'm not administering anything. I am just chairing a committee. So the executive branch, if you want, of COPUOS is the Secretariat of the United Nations, and more precisely a small team within the Secretariat, which is called the Office of Aerospace Affairs, based in Vienna. I am not part of this office. I'm just chairing a committee for 2 years, which is a bit sleepy, if you allow me this. But I feel my duty is to try to wake it up. Now, whether the committee wants to be woken up is another matter. Yes? Okay. Well, I don't believe so. I think the decision to go to this rotation system every 2 years for the chairmanship of the plenary committee, for the chairmanship of the subcommittees and the vice chairmanship and all that was taken in 1999, if I'm not mistaken. And I would see a lot of reluctance to go back on this system, which itself required a lot of discussions and negotiations in the late 90s. So, no, my answer is no. And whether it's a good thing or not, I don't know. What I can tell you is that I already know who will be my successor. He's the ambassador from Colombia. So I'm already putting him in the loop of those ideas that I have shared with you this morning. So that is at least is not doesn't find himself surprised. First of all, he's sitting as delegate from Colombia, but as chairman, he some of these ideas, if they survive, maybe they will not. But if they survive, he will have to make sure that they move forward. So some kind of link between the various successive chairmen or chairwomen can be organized. And of course, in this process, the Secretariat plays a strong role in providing the required continuity. I think, Teresa, you had a question.
I don't know if I can reach the microphone. Could you talk to us about what happened when the IAA went to COPUS? I believe they presented the traffic management study earlier this year, and I was wondering how that was received and if you thought, it might be feasible. You said you were going to introduce this idea of going forward to sort of use the IAA studies, kind of like the IADC study was used for debris.
Well, I would say that, the whole thing is a slow process. When the IAA study was presented this year, the printed report had just come out of press the day before or 2 days before, so it was distributed to the delegation. Kai Schrögl from Germany, who was one of the leaders of the study, had some personal interaction with some delegations after they had read it. I would say it's a bit early to talk about reaction. There is no. We will see that next June, because my plan is to introduce discussion on future roles and activities of the committee. And as part of this agenda item, I will mention the fact that maybe we should start addressing rules of the road type of topic. But again, let me be clear about that, not from a space weapons deployment point of view, because this is not a copious, it is not in the copious mandate, but from a point of view of ensuring the safety of space assets and space operation. And the problem is there even without any weapons deployment. Today we don't have any weapons in space, and yet we have a problem. So let's set aside the weapons matter. Let's look at what we have, which is a real problem, and that is how do we not only mitigate space debris, but how we can enforce some kind of a discipline which would basically, if not clean up the matter, because cleaning up is very difficult, but at least not increase the problem. So we'll have a better answer to your question by after the June session, I think. Yes? Okay.
You mentioned briefly the spider, formerly known as Domisco. I just came from a meeting of the International Charter actually last week, and we looked at the draft proposal, which I believe is being discussed at the General Assembly. And there was definitely some concern expressed amongst the members that the way that SPIDER was being described overlapped with the current activities of the Charter. And I was just wondering how you see SPIDER being developed in coordination with existing bodies. Obviously, there are many ISDR, GEO, without duplicating those efforts.
Well, of course, this is a question that was discussed extensively last week. First of all, with respect to the Charter, it's very simple. The resolution on SPIDER, by the way, SPIDER means UN platform, space-based information supporting disaster management, or something to that effect, okay. The idea is that it would provide to the Charter a home in the UN system, which it doesn't have today. The Charter is an arrangement, is a best effort arrangement between space agencies. And therefore, there are some countries who don't feel they are part of it. So having this resolution will facilitate participation, and that will not duplicate the Charter. It will, in fact, facilitate the Charter interaction with the UN system. Now, your second part of your question related to GEO and also to other UN-based crisis and disaster-related organization. With respect to GEO, I don't know exactly where they are today. I inquired earlier this year as to what progress they had made with respect to disaster management and so on, and the answer was that they had not made any progress at the time. I'm speaking of February, last February. I will certainly review where they are now. Now, the other thing is that there are within the UN at least two offices who have a strong role in those areas of crisis management and disaster management. One is the ISDR, the International Strategy on Disaster Management within UN, and the other one is the Office of the OCHA office, which is the Office of Humanitarian Crisis Affairs or something like that, okay, based in Geneva. And one thing which needs to be done, in reply to your question, which needs to be done is the establishment of a strong operational link between the SPIDER approach, which is managed from Vienna, the Office of Aerospace, and the OCHA office in Geneva. And this is something which requires some more work, in my view. Other questions?
Dave Turner with the Aerospace Corporation. You mentioned very briefly the role of the UN in bringing space applications to the developing world, but you didn't expand on that much. Could you comment on that a bit and talk about whether or not you see COCUAS having a bigger role in sort of magnifying what the Office for Outer Space Affairs already does try to do very actively in that area?
Well, I did not go into this because this is something where the things are going on, and the limit on the size of the activity is mostly a budgetary type of limit. That is, the Secretariat, the Office of Aerospace Affairs, is managing what is called a space application program. And as part of the space application program, they organize a very large number of training workshops and education workshops and seminars in very many parts of the world. Some of them are linked with remote sensing and geographic information system. Others are more on the application of GPS and GLONASS and Galileo. And I don't think we need to go much beyond what they are doing. I think they are doing the maximum they can do within rather restricted budget limitations. It is not very visible from the developing, from the more advanced countries, because it's not aimed at them. They are involved in that. They have experts from the more advanced country who participate and give talks and presentation during those workshops. But the workshops are really aimed at the developing countries. And I cannot say that I know enough of the overall efficiency of these activities to give an opinion whether it should be augmented or reduced. I think it would not be fair for me to comment on that. But this was not really the focus of my presentation. You know, this office is very small. And by the way, the Office of Outer Space is, I think, 35 people, and a good half. Is in fact dedicated to support the COPIOS meetings, act as secretary of the meeting, prepare the papers, make sure the translation is done in the six languages of the UN, and ensure consistency and all that. So the secretariat who can do things outside of Vienna in terms of workshops, and it's maybe 15 people at the most. Yes? Okay.
Hello. This is perhaps another unanswerable question from the Space Policy Institute, but with the release of the new U.S. National Space Policy, do you see the efforts of the committee being hindered in the future at all?
Can you repeat the question? I didn't get the question.
Sure. I'm sorry. Given the new National Space Policy of the United States, do you think that the committee will be hindered in its efforts in the future? Because the United States now seems a little bit unwilling to enter into international agreements that will restrict their access and activities in space.
Yeah, well, I know, I've read that. But, the U.S. Is a very strong actor in COPIOS, very active, in fact. And anything we will be discussing over the next few years is something in which the U.S. delegation will have a strong participation. Now, whether the new space policy as it came out on 6th of October will actually hinder the U.S. delegation. I hope not. I have a member of the delegation sitting here who is smiling. I hope, let's put it that way, I hope the U.S. delegation will continue to be as active as before. I mean, let's be realistic. In a UN system, we work by consensus. We never take a vote in the caucus, never. So every text, every piece of paper, every agenda item which is introduced is a result of a consultation of all delegations, and that, of course, includes the U.S. delegation as well as the others. So we have to try to, and that explains, of course, why the process is slow, but the strength of the process is that if we agree on something, there is an agreement among all the partners, and all, in particular, all the partners on who are main space actors. We are not going to force a text against the view of Colombia, or Venezuela, or Mexico, or the U.S., or Sweden, or Japan.
I'm Patty Grace Smith from the FAA Commercial Space Transportation Office. I find your perspective and your vision that you've articulated to be considerably more open than I've heard before from members of COPIUS and on that committee in particular. Perhaps it's the entrepreneurial perspective that you bring to COPIUS that has bearing on that. The question I wanted to ask you is what does your vision say about interoperability? And what I have in mind is there's a lot of development that is currently going on in the human spaceflight area, space tourism, as we build out the development of commercial space in this country to more of a transportation system, which is clearly where I think it is going. Interoperability plays a huge role in aviation.
Yeah.
And I'd be interested in your thoughts with respect to that in terms of space.
Well, thank you for your question. In fact, you know, if you look at this IAA study I was mentioning earlier, they have a good part of the study looks at the model of aviation. Because after all, when we talk about rules of the road, we have to look at what our colleagues do in the maritime sector and what they do in the air transportation sector. In the air transportation sector, the rules are very developed, very much more advanced than they are in the maritime sector. And therefore, there is at least a model which is a bit different, but which probably can be very useful to develop a further framework for space operation, including space transportation, with some kind of basic rules, including the interoperability factor that you mentioned. I think not enough has been done in this area so far, and I would certainly be very interested in any further contribution to this idea of looking at what is done within ICAO and see how much of it can be transported, if I may say, to the area of space operation. How much is valid, how much is not applicable, because their system of rules and regulation for navigation and so on is a very interesting one, which, of course, has demonstrated its value over the years and has facilitated the development of space air transport. So this is a model which we have to be careful. It cannot be transposed immediately, but it is a very useful model to have in mind. And you are well located to contribute to that, I should say.
Yes?
Following up on this question that Patty raised, do you see the need in the future for satellite navigation rules of the road?
Well, in the field of satellite navigation today, most satellite navigation systems are based on constellation located in the same layer of altitude and about the same range of inclination. It's not yet crowded as the geostationary orbit, plus there are different planes as opposed to the geostationary orbit where it's all in the same plane. But we still have a problem long term, and that is that what to do with the dead spacecraft. The orbit of GPS and GLONASS and later for Galileo is such that the spacecraft, which are no longer in operation, will find their orbit gradually elongating, will not stay circular, and that's because of the attraction of the Moon and the Sun. And therefore, as this happens, they will cross the operational orbit four times per revolution. And that is a big, big problem. So probably some kind of graveyard orbit concept needs to be found for these type of orbits. It's not that simple, in fact. I guess in the Interagency Debris Committee, some work will take place. Some work is already taking place, in fact. And, you know, it's a all of this is a continued effort by all parties. We have a long term, we have a problem on this orbit, and therefore we have to find solution. Since it is a long-term problem, we have a little bit of time in front of us. But in the end, it will transform into design modification at some time. In the spacecraft to find a solution to the problem. But some people are already working on it.
Another question? So thank you again, Gérard, for this contribution to our Global Space Forum. It was very insightful. I think we all wish you good luck with the UN Copios. I think you will need it, but we know you have the experience of the multilateral environment and the bilateral environment that is necessary for the success and to wake up this organization. I would like to point out before we break two points that were discussed during this forum today, and two points on which we are active at CSIS. You know, we are trying to support globally and on the long run, space exploration. For that, we have identified, just as Gérard did, that education of the developing countries is key. And I'm glad to tell you that two weeks ago, with Lynn here, we put together with UNESCO and the UN, with a very, very strong support from NASA and other space agencies, a workshop involving more than 30 countries to try to transfer the know-how and the dream and the inspiration to those developing countries, to the young in this country. So I think we are really supporting that. I think it's key. And the second point where we were very active and we will still be very active in the future is interoperability for space exploration, just as Patty mentioned. And on that point, I would like to tell you that we had a big workshop in September. FA was represented, of course, about space interoperability for space exploration. And the report will come out before the end of the month. It will be online on our website. And clearly, this is something that we have identified as critical for the long-term sustainability of space exploration. And the ICAO model was mentioned, like other models, but this is really something where there is a need for maybe governance, international governance, to make sure that on such a long-term effort that will involve more than a generation, we are able to build the flexibility early by agreeing on some maybe standards and other items that will promote interoperability. So again, thank you very much to all of you for coming to our Global Space Forum, and we'll keep you informed about our next event, and have a good day. Thank you.